Our fourth and final session of this afternoon is dramatic moves in the Gaza Strip. What are the prophetic implications of the rise of Hamas in Gaza? Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, again. And as he said, do you notice he said this is the final session for the afternoon? That sort of sense of getting our way through a bit at a time. And I did see signs of that graveyard shift in the last session. The focusing of the energies and that sort of that difficulty to decide, shall I consume what I have consumed or shall I consume what is offered? And so it's good that we've worked our way through that, really, isn't it? In fact, you all look a little bit more bright and chipper now that you've had the chance to stand up and breathe some fresh air. And I know this air conditioning is perhaps not quite, you know, coping with the fall temperatures in the hall, but hopefully we'll get through. So dramatic moves in the Gaza Strip. And what are the prophetic implications for the rise of Hamas? I suppose, in a way, by the way, you might find that one of the strange things about this particular weekend is that we haven't got a separate study on Israel, developments in Israel, and we haven't got a separate study on Russia. One of the reasons for that is that in our part of the world, we hear lectures on Russia and lectures on Russia and lectures on Russia and lectures on Russia, and Ezekiel 38 appears to be, at some stage, the only lecture chapter that any lecture knows about. And so we're going to cover Ezekiel 38 in measure in the course of our studies, but we're not going to do specifically anything on the area of Russia, nor of Israel, more with associated aspects. And I suppose this is one of them, which is what's going on in the area right around Israel itself. Now, I suppose it would be fair to say that as a community, the greatest sign of the coming of Christ that we would believe in has been, is the sign of the return of the Jewish people back to their land. We've been thrilled as a community. Of course, those of us that are showing our age that can remember back to 1948 will remember how exciting it was. Trouble is, you think, you see, time moves on. And young people say, well, Israel's always been there. But to our older brothers and sisters, it wasn't always there. And they remember the drama of the day that Israel came into existence as a nation. And some that are a little bit younger remember the excitement of 1967. And the dramatic turnaround of that war. And we oughtn't to forget, brothers and sisters, that time's moving along, and that as it does, remarkable events unfold in Bible prophecy that if we're not careful, we take for granted later on as if it had always been. So clearly the return of the Jews has been an important milestone in our expectations of the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. One of the things about Bible prophecy is this, and I suppose this is again partly what this weekend is about, is we need to be aware of the danger of not rushing out to current events and then trying to find a Bible prophecy that might fit what's happening this week in any part of the world. And therefore, one of the things that I hope we will establish over the course of our weekend is that whilst we're going to mention current events topics, that mostly what you ought to hear are Bible passages and Bible reasoning upon the subject. Because at the end of the day, we want to go away and say, not just that the current events are exciting and that we believe that Christ's return is near, but so why was that? Where did we get that from biblically as to why our expectations should be so? And it's the Bible line of evidence that we want to be interested in and take away. Because for one obvious reason is the Bible line of evidence will never change. The signs of the times will. The current events will. The latest chart of bombs and rockets or the latest testimony of some leader will. They'll all change, but not the Bible reasoning. That's the bit that will stay, and that's the bit that we want to grasp. I just wanted to say a word then about latter-day prophetic applications, because I think it's important in an overall context and especially relevant in terms of this particular study, and that's this, that not all prophecies require or necessitate both a primary and a secondary fulfillment. Context and comparison need to be used to establish whether a latter-day application is warranted. I think sometimes what happens within our community is people say, well, of course, you realize this and you realize that, and they quote passages that I think had already been fulfilled, and there's an assumption that there must always be a latter-day application. I'm not sure that that's so, brothers and sisters. What I am sure about is that we will know whether there is a latter-day application if the context demands there be. And there isn't always. And there isn't always evidence for a latter-day interpretation. But if it does exist, particularly with regard to nations, then it will be seen in one of the following ways. Either in the context of powers controlling the same territory, or powers manifesting the same attributes. And in some cases, perhaps even both of those, in terms of a latter-day application that we might expect. And lastly, some prophecies appear to have had no previous fulfillment at all, leading to the conclusion that both the primary and only consummation lies, in fact, in the latter days. We've got to be driven again by our biblical reasoning to come to a conclusion on that particular matter. Well, let's start our discussion for this afternoon then from a biblical line of reasoning. And that's that the word Palestine or Palestinian does itself have a biblical derivation, because this word, the word Palestinian, has got a background in the Bible from the word Palestina, from whence the word Palestinian is derived. It's actually the Hebrew word Pelesheth. And the word Pelesheth means migratory or wandering, hence the land of the wanderers or the sojourners. It's been translated as Palestina three times, as Palestine once, as Philistia three times, and as Philistines once. But it's actually the basis for the word Palestinian. Now, what's interesting about that when we come to current times, what we can say, therefore, is that from a scriptural or biblical perspective, a Palestinian is in fact a Philistine. And certainly in terms of today, we would say that the Palestinians of modern day not only control the same territory as the Philistines of old, but they also manifest the same attributes, and in fact they will share the same end. So it's a pretty tight fit, it's a good match, both in terms of territory and the same attributes. And interestingly enough, the Arabic word for Palestine liberation is Tahriya Philistine. And you can see that interplay between the word Philistine, Philistine, and Palestine, Palestine. It's all the same word in the Hebrew, in fact. Now, I want to just put a caveat on everything I've said about this from a biblical point of view. We need to make it clear that the modern Palestinians are not in any way the actual descendants of the Philistines of Old Testament times. They're not related in any way, shape or form. There's no ethnic or linguistic or cultural connection between them. The Philistines of Old Testament times are completely gone. They were exterminated. In fact, we're going to see the prophecies of judgment that were uttered against the Philistines a little bit later on. And we can say that they are absolutely gone. The Palestinian people that are here today are not Philistines. They're Arabs. And I suppose we would have to say that in measure, the whole story of the Palestinian people of modern days is one of the greatest media frauds that's ever been perpetrated upon the Western world in particular. Because, of course, you know what happened. What happened was this. Is around about the time of the state of Israel being declared, there was a large influx, not just of Jewish people, but of Arabs into the region of Mandate Palestine. And many of those Arabs had come from other nations. And you know why they came? They came because there was employment, because there was commerce, because there was economic activity, because there were jobs. And they came from Tunisia and from Morocco and from Saudi Arabia and from Syria and from Iraq and from all over the Arab world. They flowed into Mandate Palestine. Now, by the way, it's also true that a number of people living in Palestine at that time of Arab descent had lived there for a long time, in some cases for many generations. No doubt about that. And when the 1948 War of Independence occurred, some Arab people were clearly dispossessed from their villages and from their lands. Actually, you might also know that when the 1948 War of Independence occurred, the Jewish radio broadcast an appeal to all Arabs not to go, but to stay. They said, we want to live together, side by side in Palestine. But the Arab radio said, no, go, go, get out, leave now, because we're going to destroy Israel and cast them into the sea, and you'll only have to leave your villages for a short number of days, and you can return in victory. But the only trouble is they didn't win. The Arabs didn't win. Israel won one of its first major miraculous battles, and those Arab people were dispossessed and unable to return, and the beginning of the Palestinian refugee crisis emerged. By the way, you might know, or you might not know, that up till the year 1948, the year that Jewish independence was declared, the word Palestinian always referred to a Jew living in Palestine, not an Arab. Palestinian was a term for a Jew living in Palestine up till 1948. Now, when the Jewish refugee situation, not the Jewish, when the Palestinian refugee situation began in 1948 because of these dispossessed Palestinians, the United Nations Relief Agency came in. They said, well, we better do something about this. We've got to provide relief and look after these refugees. So they got out their notebook and they said, well, the first thing we need to do is, well, you know, what's your names? And well, now, hang on a minute. How do we define a Palestinian refugee for purposes of receiving assistance? So they decided. And the definition of a Palestinian refugee was, well, as long as you'd lived in Mandate Palestine for 24 months, you were deemed to be a Palestinian refugee. So what actually happened, you see, is Arabs came from Tunisia and had been living in Mandate Palestine for all of 2 years, and now they had been apparently cruelly torn from their ancient homeland by the Jewish people. This ancient homeland that they lived in for 24 months or more. And they weren't Palestinian. There's no Palestinian language, brothers and sisters. There's no Palestinian culture. There's no Palestinian separate identity. They were Arabs living in Palestine. That's all they were. And let me tell you something. Let me tell you something else rather strange. From 1948 through to 1967, when Israel took control of the West Bank and of the city of Jerusalem, that whole area was under the control and jurisdiction and occupation of what power? Why, the power of Jordan. And the remarkable thing is that from 1948 to 1967, when Jordan controlled that whole territory, no Palestinian nation, no Palestinian individual, no Palestinian group stood up and said, we want our ancient homeland back. They only discovered that they were Palestinians once the Jews controlled it. Isn't it strange? It's all a media fraud. And the Arabs, by the way, are very good at perpetrating media frauds. And the bottom line is that anything that the Jews have got, the Arabs will claim, whether it's truthful or not. So let's come back to our Bibles then and have a look at the biblical basis for this story of the Palestinians, and in particular, how we might weave Gaza and Hamas into that story in the latter days. In Exodus chapter 15, we're told this. Exodus chapter 15 says, and reading from verse 13, thou in thy mercy hast led forth the people which thou hast redeemed. Thou hast guided them in thy strength unto thy holy habitation. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. The mighty men of Moab trembling shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. By the greatness of thine arm they shall be as still as a stone, till thy people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over which thou hast purchased. Thou shalt bring them in and plant them in the mountain of their inheritance. And what we're being told here is that into this land came the Jewish people in their story, in their journey out of Egypt into the promised land. And we're told, verse 14, that the inhabitants of Palestina would be in sorrow. And the reason why they were going to be in sorrow is because this land had been promised to Israel. And in fact, it's interesting. I think we know where Palestina probably was, because if you look at verse 15 and come to the end of verse 15, it says, all the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. And Canaan was in the center of the land. And just before that, it says, the mighty men of Moab trembling shall take hold upon them. But Moab was to the east. And then at the top of verse 15, it says, then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed, but Edom was to the south. And then it says in verse 14, sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina, and clearly Palestina, by implication, lay to the west. Did it not? The whole of all the nations in this particular area trembled at the knowledge that Israel was marching to take possession of a land that God Almighty had promised unto them. And in fact, Palestina was based on the coastal strip in biblical times. In fact, if we look at the Old Testament map and see how that worked out, it was exactly as the book of Joshua tells us. Because we're told in Joshua chapter 13, the record says, all the borders of the Philistines or Palestinians, the five lords, the Gazathites, so that's there, the Ashdothites, so that's there, the Ashkelonites, so that's there, the Gittites, and that's there, and the Ekronites, which is there, and in total, this constituted Palestina in Old Testament times, sitting along that coastal region, by the way, where exactly modern Gaza is today. And although that was part of the land promised to Israel, the problem was they never took it. And they never took it because they didn't have the faith, brothers and sisters. They never had the faith to subdue the Philistines completely. And so those of Palestina were always there in Old Testament times, and they were a thorn in the side of Israel, a pricking briar in the side of Israel, because they could never defeat them completely. And that controversy was there with the Palestinians from that time forth because of the lack of faith in the days of Joshua to drive them out from the land. And once they got there, and Palestina was sitting alongside or living alongside the Jewish people, there was controversy that never stopped in the course of the Bible record. Now, let me show you a couple of illustrations of that controversy at work. In your right hand, you need Psalm 108. Psalm 108, one of the Psalms of David. And in your left hand, you need 1 Chronicles chapter 18 and verse 1. So two illustrations, biblically, of that controversy that raged between Israel in their land and the Palestinians of Old Testament times, sitting on the coastal plain, but acting as a constant source of hostility to Israel. Now, in one of the Psalms of David, Psalm 108, it says this, and reading from verse 6, that thy beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand, and answer me. God hath spoken in his holiness. Now, you see that phrase in verse 7, God hath spoken in his holiness. I believe that that is a reference to the great covenant that God made with David in the 2 Samuel chapter 7. Because, you see, in that covenant promise that was made with David, the great Davidic covenant, do you remember what it said? God said through the mouth of his servant, the prophet Nathan, I will give thee rest from all thine enemies round about. And so he did. And David wrote this psalm as a result of that covenant promise. And he says, verse 7, God hath spoken in his holiness, I will rejoice. I will divide Shechem and mete out the valley of Succoth. Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim also is the strength of mine head. Judah is my lawgiver, Moab is my washpot. Over Edom will I cast out my shoe. Over Palestina will I triumph. And that's the word in the Hebrew, Palestina. There it is. Over Palestina will I triumph, was the cry of David, because of the covenant promise given him that he would subdue his enemies. Now, in your left hand, see how that worked out. Because, well, you see what it says, 1 Chronicles chapter 18 and verse 1. Now, it came to pass after this. Well, what was after this? after the Davidic covenant of the 1 Chronicles 17, after this it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them and took Gath and her towns out of the hand of the Philistines. 1 Chronicles 18 and verse 1. So David says, I'm going to triumph over Palestina, Psalm 108. And he went forth in the assurance of God and subdued that very territory, says the 1 Chronicles chapter 18 and verse 1. There was hostility between these two powers. Well, here's another example. Come now in your right hand to Isaiah chapter 14 and in your left hand to the 2 Kings chapter 18. Because now we've come all the way through to Hezekiah's time. Many, many generations later in the history and the chronology of the kings of Israel and Judah. And we've got Isaiah 14, in fact the end of Isaiah 14, in your right hand, and the 2 Kings chapter 18 in your left hand. And here's what it says. Isaiah 14, verse 28. In the year that King Ahaz died, was this burden. And by the way, I believe that the burden of verse 28 is the burden of what follows. It's the burden of verses 29 to 32. And we'll see why in a minute. In the year that King Ahaz died, was this burden. Verse 29. Rejoice not thou, whole Palestina, because the rod of him that smote thee is broken. Ahaz had died. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth a cockatrice, and his fruit shall be a fiery flying serpent. Hezekiah was to spring forth from Ahaz and would renew the battle against the Palestinians. And verse 30 says, and the firstborn of the poor shall feed, and the needy shall lie down in safety. But, says Rodahims, but I will kill thy root with famine, and he, this one to step forth, shall slay thy remnant. And so the prophecy of Isaiah 14 was that if Palestine thought they would be granted some respite because of the death of Ahaz, they were mistaken, because Hezekiah, Ahaz's son, would renew the hostilities against them until they had been subdued. And that's exactly what 2 Kings 18 says. Did you notice it? Have a look at this. 2 Kings 18 and verse 1. Now, it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. What year do you think it would be that Hezekiah began to reign? Well, I suppose in the year that his father, after his father had died. In the year that King Ahaz died was this burden, says Isaiah 14. And in the year that King Ahaz dies, Hezekiah comes to the throne. 2 Kings 18 and verse 1. And you see what it says? See what it says about him? Verse 7. 2 Kings 18. And Yahweh was with him, and he prospered whithersoever he went forth, and he rebelled against the king of Assyria and served him not. He smote the Philistines, even unto Gaza and the borders thereof, from the tower to the watchman, from the tower of the watchman to the fenced city. And so here's that same controversy in the days of David manifesting itself in the same controversy between Israel and the Palestinians in the days of Hezekiah. And he fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 14 and the burden against Palestina. And it didn't matter, brothers and sisters, it didn't matter how long the kings of Judah warred against the Palestinians, they could never solve that problem. So much so that in the end, God uttered a series of prophecies of judgment against Palestina. And he did so because of their spirit of unrelenting hostility towards Israel. Now, by the way, it was really a fulfillment of Genesis chapter 12. I will bless them that blesseth thee, and I will curse them that curseth thee. And because the Palestinians never ceased to curse Israel, in the end God prophesied judgment against them, and so it came to pass. The first of those was in Amos chapter 1, a prophecy of judgment against the Philistines. It was fulfilled by Pharaoh Necho of Egypt. There's a second one in Jeremiah chapter 47 that was also fulfilled by Pharaoh Necho of Egypt. There's a third one in Ezekiel chapter 25. That was fulfilled by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. There's a fourth one in Zechariah chapter 9. That was fulfilled by Alexander of Greece. And lastly, there is a fifth prophecy of judgment against the Philistines in Zephaniah chapter 2, which was fulfilled by Judas Maccabeus of Israel. And what we can say, and I think with reasonable certainty, brothers and sisters, is that by the time these judgments were fulfilled, the Philistines were gone from the earth, absolutely gone. In the providence and wisdom of God, those judgments had been executed, and the Philistines were no longer. And by the way, I'm not at all convinced that those prophecies have any secondary or subsequent fulfillment. I think they've already been fulfilled. But of course the question is, the real question is, but if Israel is back in the land, if Israel's back in the land in fulfillment of Bible prophecy, is there anything biblically that might expect us to see a revival of Palestina at the time of the end, as well as the revival of Israel? In other words, do we expect to see both of them back there at the time of the end, and perhaps a revival of their hostilities? What does the Bible say about that? And the answer is, I think there is some Bible evidence that would suggest just that. In other words, the possibility that Palestina might well be revived on its ancient territory. Well, let me walk you through three or four key passages that would suggest that that might be so. The first of them is Psalm 83. Now, Psalm 83 is quite an interesting psalm, again, not the least of which is because it's pressed into service in the Brotherhood for proving things that I don't think it really proves, but we'll come to that in a moment. Psalm 83, it's suggested, is the story of a latter-day battle against the Jewish people, and this confederates, verse 6, Edom, Moab, Hagarines, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, all of these people listed in Psalm 83. In fact, what's suggested is that there's 10 names, and it answers to the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2, and therefore the last stage of Daniel chapter 2 is the Jews versus the Arabs at the time of the end. And moreover, Psalm 83 is offered as evidence that there's going to be a terrible defeat for the children of Israel by those Arab powers at the time of the end, that Israel's going to be destroyed by the Arabs. Proof? Why? Psalm 83. Well, I don't think that Psalm 83 actually proves that at all. In fact, quite possibly, the very opposite. Of course, you realize that most psalms have an historical background, and I think this one's no exception. Again, if you hold your hand in Psalm 83 and come to the second of Chronicles and chapter 20, let's just see what the background might have been to Psalm 83. It's one of the psalms of the house of Asaph, says the record, and we believe it was uttered at some stage in the history of that family and their involvement with Israel. So, 2 Chronicles 20 in your left hand and Psalm 83 in your right hand. Now, do you notice what it says in Psalm 83, verse 5? Whoever came against Israel, it was obviously a great multitude, because it says they've consulted together with one consent, they are confederate against thee. There was a confederacy of nations, a confederacy of people that came against Israel on this occasion. But that's the very spirit of 2 Chronicles 20. You see what it says, verse 2 of Chronicles. Then there came some that told Jehoshaphat, saying, there cometh a great multitude against thee. A great multitude, says the record. And again in verse 12 it's going to say, in the prayer of Jehoshaphat, our God wilt thou not judge them, for we have no might against this great company that cometh against us. And again in verse 15, a man of God will stand up and encourage the nation and say, be not afraid nor dismayed by reason of this great multitude. So we suggest that the great multitude of 2 Chronicles chapter 20 is the large confederacy of nations of Psalm 83 verse 5, all gathered together to consult against the people of God. And you notice that Psalm 8 says that there was a ringleader to this particular battle. Someone led the whole confederacy. Now who led the confederacy of Psalm 83? Well, you notice that right at the end of the verse it says, Asher is joined with them, colon, and then it says, they, which presumably means all of the ones mentioned above, have holpen the children of Lot. Now, who were the children of Lot? Answer, Ammon and Moab. Do you see what 2 Chronicles 20, verse 1 says? It came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon and with them other besides. Ah, so who led the confederacy in the days of Jehoshaphat? Why, the children of Moab and the children of Ammon. But that's the children of Lot, isn't it, of Psalm 83. They've all holpen the children of Lot. And again, by the way, in verse 23 of 2 Chronicles 20, it says, for the children of Ammon and the children of Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir. This was a confederacy led by the children of Lot, says 2 Chronicles. Psalm 83 says, this was a confederacy led by the children of Lot. Do you notice in Psalm 83, and verse 12, it says that when this confederacy came down, they said, let us take to ourselves the houses of God in possession. And in my Bible, anyway, the margin says, why, see 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 11, and the prayer of Jehoshaphat that said that all these have come, they've come against us to cast us out of the possession which thou hast given us to inherit. And there's a word or there's a thought link to 2 Chronicles chapter 20 in the very language of the psalm. And here's a really interesting connection, and that's this. Whoever wrote this psalm, Psalm 83, this is how he closed. This was his final prayer, verse 18. Let them be confounded, verse 17, and put to shame for this reason, verse 18, that men may know that thou, whose name alone is Yahweh, art the Most High over all the earth. The psalmist said, please grant us a victory this day, that all the nations may know the greatness of God, that thou art Yahweh, the Most High, over all the earth. Do you think that prayer was answered, brothers and sisters? Yes, I think so, because come and have a look at what happened in the 2nd of Chronicles chapter 20. Of course, you realize what they did. They sent the singers in front of the army, didn't they? They put the hymn singers in front of the army. Brave singers were these that marched in front of the army. And the remarkable thing is that when the choir got to the scene of battle, Almighty God had arrived before them and destroyed the host. And so the record says in verse 27 of 2 Chronicles 20, then they returned every man of Judah and Jerusalem, and Jehoshaphat in the forefront of them, to go again to Jerusalem with joy. For Yahweh had made them to rejoice over their enemies. And verse 29 says this, and the fear of God was on all the kingdoms of those countries when they heard that Yahweh fought against the enemies of Israel. And the psalmist had said, let them all be put to shame that men may know that thou art the Most High God. And in the days of Jehoshaphat it said, and all the nations were frightened when they heard that God had so fought. Oh, I think there's a link here, see? I think that Psalm 83 is set in the days of Jehoshaphat. Now, of course, you realize why that's important or perhaps helpful. I think because if there is to be a latter-day application of Psalm 83, and by the way, we haven't established that yet. We haven't actually proved that, have we? If there is to be a latter-day application of Psalm 83, do you think it will betoken a Jewish defeat or a brilliant Jewish victory? What thinkest thou, based on the story of Jehoshaphat? And the answer is that I don't think that Psalm 83 is going to indicate a defeat or an overthrow of the Jewish people at the time of the end. I think probably the very opposite. Not a catastrophic defeat by the Palestinians, but in fact a brilliant victory for Israel over their enemies after the manner and spirit of Jehoshaphat of old. And now we see the key phrase coming out of Psalm 83, which I can now put on the board, which says in Psalm 83 that amongst those that come in opposition to Israel at that time, it says in verses 6 and 7, are the tabernacles of Edom and Moab and Ammon and Amalek and Palestina. So that word Philistines is actually our word Palestina. Palestina, and then it says, notice this, with the inhabitants of Tyre. I want you to notice that. So who's Palestina connected with? With the inhabitants of Tyre up the road, up the coast, further up. Palestine is on the coast. The inhabitants of Tyre are on the coast. And those two powers are linked together in some way, and Psalm 83. Now, what's interesting about Tyre? Well, what's modern-day Tyre? What's there at the moment? Of course, it's Lebanon. But who's in control of that southern part of Lebanon? And the answer is Hezbollah. And so down in Gaza, we've got Hamas. And up in Tyre, we've got Hezbollah. And there's a connection between the two, which we'll look at as our story unfolds. Here's a second passage in Obadiah chapter. Now, that's tricky, isn't it? Because there is only one chapter in Obadiah. So I guess we'd have to say chapter 1. Here's an interesting reference in the book of Obadiah. Now, Obadiah is one of those tricky little prophets, isn't it? If you get to Amos, you haven't gone far enough. If you reach the book of Jonah, you've overshot. It's quite easy to do with the prophecy of Obadiah. But notice this, in terms of what Obadiah says. He says in verse 17, upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. So moving forward in the prophecy of Obadiah, it would seem that the final fulfillment of deliverance upon Mount Zion would perhaps yet lie in the future in its entirety, as would verse 21, and saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. The kingdom shall be the Lord's. Yet to come in the complete fulfillment of the prophecy. Now, what's interesting, in the middle of that, it says this, in the book of Obadiah, it says, they of the plain, verse 19, that's the coastal plain, isn't it? Those of the plain shall possess the Philistines, or the Palestinians. And then it goes on to say, in verse 20, that they will possess even unto Zarephath. Now, by the way, where's Zarephath? Anyone know where Zarephath is? Yes. Where is Zarephath? It's between Tyre and Zidon, up the coast in Lebanon. Between Tyre and Zidon. So again, we're told in Obadiah that when Israel takes final possession against all their enemies, they possess the coastal plain where the Palestinians were, and right up into Lebanon, says the record, even unto Zarephath. And those two spots are brought together again in the prophecy of Obadiah. Now, by the way, you might look at that and say, well, I can't say that that's convincing, that Psalm 83 or even Obadiah necessarily have some long-range latter-day fulfillment. But this one does, because in Joel, let's turn to Joel because we're not too far away. If we come back to the book of Joel, notice my little helpful hint there, so you knew which direction to travel. If you come back to the prophecy of Joel, you remember that Joel 3 says, for behold, in those days and at that time when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. And of course, one of the things that Christadelphians have long since said about the prophecy of Joel is that this is a latter-day prophecy, the final threshing of the nations in the land, a heap of sheaves and a valley for judgment, and the final controversy being outworked there. We know that. That's latter-day, isn't it? The book of Joel, chapter 3. Well, you see what verse 4 says? Yea, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon, and all the coasts of Palestina? Will ye render me a recompense? And if ye recompense me, swiftly and speedily will I return your recompense upon your own head. Now clearly what Joel is suggesting is that in some way the recompense of God upon the coasts of Palestina is in retribution for some evil wherewith they have recompensed God. And presumably, brothers and sisters, God's judgment can only be outworked on the coasts of Palestina at the time of Joel chapter 3 if there are Palestinians in Palestina for God to work his judgments upon. And notice that Palestina again is addressed in this rather strange way, not only with Tyre and Zidon, but all the coasts of Palestina. You see, there's something fishy about all this. Something very fishy. In fact, you can smell the sea air here. The coasts of Palestine. And that breath, by the way, that breath of, of sea air that we feel in that prophecy is going to become apparent as the story of Palestina unfolds. Why should we be told about the seaside air of the coasts of Palestina? Well, our last reference is in Isaiah chapter 11. And by the way, I think this one probably puts the matter beyond dispute, that there is clearly some latter-day application that would suggest a revival of Palestina on its ancient territory. And here's why. Because of what Isaiah 11 says. You remember that Isaiah 11 says in verse 10 that in that day there'll be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, and to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. It shall come to pass that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people. The ensign's back in the land, Lord Jesus Christ. So Christ has returned. And then verse 13 says, the envy of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah. Judah shall not vex Ephraim. All fellowship groups will be bound together in harmony. All vexation is gone. And when Israel is returned and restored, it says in verse 14, but they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. And presumably, brothers and sisters, the Israel of that day, who come out of dispersion, can only fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines to the west if there is a Palestina to the west to fly upon. And so I think the cumulative weight, therefore, of these four passages, Psalm 83, Obadiah 19 and 20, Joel chapter 3, and Isaiah 11 would certainly suggest some revival of Palestina upon her ancient territory is very likely at the time of the end. And isn't it interesting that, well, where are they based? Where is this Palestinian enclave based? Why, in Gaza. One of the very cities of the five lords of the Philistines of Old Testament times, and that's exactly where it is. Do you know, in the Oslo Peace Accord, when they tried to hammer out a deal with the Palestinians, the first proposed capital of any Palestinian state was going to be the city of Gaza. They said, let's put it there, let's make that the capital. That's really remarkable that that's where the focus of interest and attention is. And by the way, not only are they back in the land, but they are clearly showing the same spirit as Palestina of old, are they not, brothers and sisters? Because what we're seeing in the land today is that spirit of continuous hatred that used to be once manifested by the Philistines and is now manifested by the Palestinians. In fact, one of those prophecies of judgment said this. In Ezekiel chapter 25, it said, because the Philistines have dealt by revenge and have taken vengeance with a despiteful heart to destroy with perpetual hatred. That word perpetual is the word olam. Is an everlasting hatred. It's the hatred of all ages and of all time. It's relentless. It's unending. It's irreconcilable. It's unresolvable. It's perpetual. And that's what makes it such a hateful spirit, you see, as far as God is concerned, is it's the spirit of those that are in constant enmity against Israel and have always been so down through time. In fact, we'd have to say that that spirit right now, that spirit in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, is the spirit of Hamas, is it not? Because one of the interesting things about Hamas is that Hamas, of course, well, Hamas have a special spirit, don't they, which is that they really have the old idea of the Palestinians at the start of the story, which is no peace with Israel, no negotiation with Israel, no recognition of Israel. That's Hamas's openly stated position. In fact, Hamas has said, have they not, that their position is they intend to destroy Israel. Hamas is quite open about that. They intend to destroy Israel. Now, I want you to think, brothers and sisters, about the dramatic sweep of circumstances that has led to the establishment of a state of affairs in the Gaza Strip in recent times, and just how marvellously it's been outworked in fulfilment of those Bible prophecies that we saw indicating some Palestinian presence there at the time of the end. Because this is what happened. It hasn't taken all that long, just a year or two. See, what happened is Israel decided that they would withdraw from the coastal strip of Gaza. And to do that, they had to close down all their settlements and take all the Jewish people out. About 8,000 Jews, weren't there, removed from the Gaza Strip, from Gush Katif and other settlements. In fact, the last settlement that was finally removed was the settlement of Netzarim on the coast, the last Jewish settlement. And the soldiers went in and they hugged the people before taking them out. But the government had decided we're going to withdraw. And they withdrew completely, and not only in terms of the people, but they closed all the settlements, removed all the military personnel, and handed over all responsibility for the government of Gaza to the PLO. Now, here's the question, brothers and sisters. Do you know the man that did that? The man in Israel that did that? Why? Ariel Sharon, the old battle warrior himself. Why on earth would an old battle warrior give up the whole of the Gaza Strip to Hamas, as it were, without a fight? Well, the thing is, he didn't give it up to Hamas. He gave it up to the PLO. And I think that Sharon was engaging in political brinksmanship for this reason. I think what Sharon... See, Sharon was under pressure at the time to negotiate away part of the West Bank. And I think what Sharon did was this. It was actually quite clever in a way. He said, let's withdraw from Gaza and allow the PLO to run a Palestinian state from Gaza. And then we can say to the world, now look, we've done this, we've given them a chance. Now, if they behave and they act in a fraternal spirit to their Jewish counterparts on the other side of the border, and they learn to behave and live side by side, then we've got a basis for discussing further developments in the West Bank as well. But of course, Sharon knew that he was giving it to the Arabs, and that the Arabs are the son of Ishmael. And that Ishmael's spirit was that his hand will be against every man's hand, and every man's hand against him. And he knew that the Arabs would horribly fight one another and continue to fight Israel. And Sharon could then say to all the world, and to the West in particular, well, we tried, we did our very best, but look at them. They can't even agree amongst themselves. And so it's just not possible that we can negotiate now on the West Bank or the city of Jerusalem. I'm terribly sorry, but we did try our very best, you know. See, it was a game of political brinksmanship to take the pressure off. But you see, what Sharon didn't bank on was one thing. Well, one thing apart from his stroke, which he probably didn't bank on either. And that was this, that a PLO election that followed brought a dramatic result with Hamas elected to government on the basis of, we will destroy Israel and we will not recognize them in any way. And of course, what's happened subsequently is a brutal internal battle for control, not of the West Bank, but for Gaza. And you know that battle has been taking place just in recent weeks. A brutal battle for who controls Gaza. And I mean brutal. Hamas would take people from Fatah, that supported Fatah, out of their houses and shoot them. They would throw children out of windows. They would bomb women. This is Arab on Arab, Palestinian on Palestinian, Hamas on Fatah. Who's going to control this particular region of Gaza? And what's happened is that Hamas has entirely routed Fatah right out of the Gaza Strip in its totality. So much so that news agencies are now referring to the West Bank as Fatah land and to the Gaza Strip as Hamasistan. And by the way, that's a dramatic fulfillment, really, in complete alignment with what we expect in terms of Bible prophecy. Because we expect from Bible prophecy that the West Bank will be under Jewish control when Gog arrives. And to do that, there needs to be some negotiation with the Palestinians there, which Fatah might do. But that any Palestinian entity in Gaza, we expect to be hostile to Israel at the time of the end, as Joel 3 and Isaiah 11 and Obadiah and Psalm 83 would suggest that we ought to believe. And you know what happened on the day that Hamas took final control? Israel declared to all the world that they now considered the Gaza Strip to be, quote, unquote, a hostile entity. We now regard Gaza as a hostile entity. See, that's the spirit of Palestina of Old Testament times, isn't it? All back in the land again at the time of the end. Now, here's the really interesting question. So who's funding Hamas? Where's the money coming from? And the answer is the money that funded Hamas into that victory came from the same source that funded Hezbollah into taking control of southern Lebanon, around about where Tyre and Zidon are. So where did the money come from? Well, it came from Syria, but it came from deeper than that. It comes from Iran. It's funneled through Syria. Now, what's interesting about that channel of money is this. And I mentioned this in a lecture the other night. You see, Iran is Shiite. And Shiite doctrine is different to Sunni doctrine amongst the Muslims. Sunni Muslims tend to be more moderate regimes. But the Shiites have a doctrine that does not allow them to be tolerant or moderate as far as Israel's concerned. Because Shiite belief in the successors of Muhammad himself leads to their belief that there is a hidden one, the 12th Imam, they call him, who's waiting to reappear to lead an Islamic renaissance in the world. And guess what marks the mark of the reappearance of the hidden Imam? The destruction of Israel. And the Shiites are doctrinally committed to that idea. That Israel must be destroyed in order for the hidden Imam to appear, who will lead us all to a golden age of new Islamic renaissance. They have a doctrinal statement of faith that demands the destruction of Israel. And money from Iran is going into Hezbollah up the coast and down into Gaza, with Hamas and Hezbollah both being funded by Iran, but driven by Shiite doctrine. And now we know why Joel mysteriously says the coasts of Palestina in conjunction with Tyre and Sidon. And why Obadiah says they'll possess the coasts and unto Zarephath. And why Psalm 83 says Palestina will be associated with the coastlands of Tyre and Sidon. And we've got a division of what's going on in the land right now, consistent with what we believe about Bible prophecy. And of course, one thing we can say for sure is that if Israel had never thought about it before, they'll have worked it out now, and that is that any peace treaty they've signed with the PLO is actually worthless. Mind you, if they'd gone to the Bible, they would have known that, because these are the poems of Palestina in the scripture, and they're poems of conquest, never of peace. Do you remember how Exodus said, the people shall hear and be afraid, and sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina? Do you remember how Psalm 108 said, over Palestina will I triumph? And how Isaiah 14 said, hold Palestina, thou art to be dissolved. You see, the poems of the Bible about Palestina are about conquest and not peace. In fact, we could say that Israel only ever enjoyed peace when they brought this particular territory into subjection. So let me just walk through some passages about that, which we won't read, we won't refer to, but we'll just make note of as we pass. That there was safety for Israel only when Palestina was subdued. So here's the testimony of the Bible. David smote the Philistines and subdued them and took Gath and her towns. Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms of the river unto the land of the Philistines, for he had dominion to Gaza. The fear of the Lord fell upon all the kingdoms, and the Philistines, the Palestinians, brought Jehoshaphat, tribute, silver. And again, in the days of Uzziah, we're told that he went forth and warred against the Palestinians and built cities about Ashdod and among the Philistines or the Palestinians. And again of Hezekiah, that he smote the Philistines even unto Gaza and the borders thereof. Now what's interesting about all those kings is they all had alliances with other nations. David, Solomon, Hezekiah, Jehoshaphat all had alliances with other nations. But the kings of Judah never, ever, ever negotiated peace treaties with Palestina, because peace in this area only came about when they were under military subjection. So have you ever stopped to ask this question, brothers and sisters? And that is, how do you think that the peace and safety of Ezekiel 38 might come about at the time of the end? Well, I give you two options. Either a peaceful negotiation with all Palestinian parties, or a military confrontation, which Israel wins. I think that the last of those two is probably much more likely from a prophetic viewpoint, especially if Psalm 83 is going to be any indicator. One last brilliant victory for Israel that finally puts their enemies in their place. And I don't know what it might be. I can't say with confidence necessarily that it will absolutely be so, but I think it's a possibility. And I don't know what would trigger it, but it could be something such as the PLO doing something outrageous, like blowing up the Temple Mount or destroying another Jewish president or something that even the world says, that's shocking, and gives Israel the license to do two things. To go into the West Bank and take absolute control and to put a ring of steel around Gaza that nobody can get in or out or through or underneath or over or across and say, you will be under our control and you will live in that place and behave. And that ring of steel would leave that spirit of hatred contained inside Gaza that broods and festers just like it did in Old Testament times. And I think that is the setting of the scene for the invasion of Gog in the latter days. Now, let me mention something about that that's relevant to our particular study today. What was the greatest catastrophe of Israel in Old Testament times, do you think? I would say the overthrow by Nebuchadnezzar, the sacking of the temple, and the taking of Israel into captivity. It was the greatest calamity of Old Testament times that happened to the nation. Question. When Nebuchadnezzar came down, were there some associated nations that threw in their lot with Nebuchadnezzar because of their hatred of the Jews? Yes. Were they the main story? No. Who was the main story? Nebuchadnezzar. Who's Nebuchadnezzar? Babylon versus Israel. Now we come to the New Testament. What do you think the greatest calamity that the Jewish people have experienced in the New Testament era? Why? Clearly, AD 70, the overthrow of the Jewish Commonwealth under Vespasian and Titus. When Titus came down, brothers and sisters, were there some surrounding peoples that threw in their lot with the Romans to settle some old scores against the Jewish people? Yes. Were they the main story? No. Who was the main story? Titus. Who's Titus? Babylon. Rome. When Gog comes down at the time of the end, might there be some Arab nations that become accomplices of Gog to wreak vengeance upon Israel? Yes. Will those Arab nations be the main story? No. What will be the main story? Gog. Who's Gog? Babylon. The military aspect of Babylon at the time of the end, brothers and sisters. And I think that we know from Scripture what Palestina's role might be at the time of the end in regard to that advance of Gog. So here it is. Do you remember how that in the book of Zechariah we're told that when Gog comes down, and of course I'm assuming that Zechariah 14 and Joel 3 and Daniel 11 and Ezekiel 38 are companion prophecies, and I think moreover that we can prove that that's so. But when it does, it says this, does it not, in Zechariah? It says, the city shall be taken and the houses rifled, and half the city shall go forth into captivity. You ever stop to think about that? Jewish people are going to be deported into captivity, says Zechariah chapter 14, when Gog comes down. Question is, how will they be deported? And where will they be deported from? But what do you make of this passage? Joel 3. Yea, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon, and all the coasts of Palestina? The children of Judah have ye sold unto the Grecians. Ah, so that's what Palestina will do. They will be involved in selling Jewish people into captivity in conjunction with Gog. And maybe for that reason we now understand why it is that Isaiah 11 says, he shall gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth, and they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines. Actually, by the way, what Isaiah says is that when the ensign comes, he'll gather the outcasts of Israel and the dispersed of Judah. you know, there's a little bit of a problem in Isaiah 11, because Israel and Judah are two different terms prophetically. Judah are those in the land when Christ comes. Israel are those still scattered. How come there's those of Judah still coming back to the land in Isaiah chapter 11? The answer is because they're some of the ones that were sold into captivity. And the first thing they do when they of Judah come back, having been dispersed in the captivity, is they fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines to the west, as if to suggest that these are they who sold them into captivity at the time of the end. I think Palestine is going to put up her hand and say to Gog, we've got coastline here. Let's ship them off from Palestina and send the Jews away into other parts. I think we're being told that Palestina will be Gog's ally in Jewish deportations at the time of the end. That's the role she'll play. And here's another piece of evidence with regard to that that's quite interesting. Funny thing how, as we said before, once you see something, you see something. This was a statement in the Christadelphian of 2005 under Signs of the Times. An agreement has been reached to allow the Palestinians to rebuild their port just south of Gaza City, not far from where the settlement of Netzarim once stood. The port is being seen as a symbol of Palestinian independence and as their economic gateway to the world. Well, 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 the Palestinians are building port facilities for shipping just off the coast of Palestine. Now, isn't that interesting? And I think there's one final fulfillment yet to come, you see, of Deuteronomy, which says, and the Lord shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships by the way whereof I spake unto thee. Thou shalt never see it or see it no more. And there shall ye be sold unto your enemies. And by ships they shall go. One last time, brothers and sisters, off the coasts of Palestina, in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Quite remarkable. So what's our expectations then concerning this area at the time of the end? Well, I think we can expect the following from a biblical perspective. I think we expect to see the increasing drive of independent Palestinian activity in the coastal region of the Gaza Strip. I think we expect to see the increasing tendency of the Palestinian movement in Gaza to foment a state of enmity with Israel as they did in ancient times. I think there is an increasing likelihood that Israel's security with Gaza Palestinians will not come by peace, but eventually by some form of military control yet to be outworked. I think we can expect the increasing tension of the Palestinian conflict in Gaza to presage the invasion of Gog and the return of our Lord Jesus Christ. Aren't we living, brothers and sisters, in absolutely remarkable times? And how wonderful that Bible prophecy, in its various many aspects, all comes together to hang on that framework of Bible prophecy to tell us that our Lord's coming is near and that we need to prepare for him. And why we should do that, God willing, we should look at in our studies tonight.